Well, thank you, Steve. There are the sign-in sheets for the follow-up email with the three lectures and any follow-up information. They're around on the table somewhere. Okay. So to the Toronto housing bubble. So I moved to Canada now almost 2 years ago, and this is about all I've heard. Every time I read the news, right, last year housing went up 15%, and this year 33%, something like that. And now they're talking about introducing rent control. And it's not just Toronto, but there's this problem that housing keeps going up and up and up, and it becomes less and less affordable for people who already don't yet own houses, who have to rent, who want to buy. So the question I want to explore is what does halakha have to say about pricing, both for buying houses, for renting houses, on two levels. One, on the question of whether there is such a thing, or what would it mean for the price to be too high. And the second is, do we have any right to try to control the price as it continues to rocket up? So we will start with the same sources that we did last time. So number one is the source for the laws of Onah. So just a bit of review. We mentioned 2 weeks ago, and I think Shekhinah probably discussed it again last week. There are two distinct concepts in halakha that we need to discuss. One is called Onah, the laws of overcharging, really deceptive overcharging, or as someone who emailed me about the lecture said, not necessarily deceptive, but any case when you're taking advantage of ignorance, but basically deceptive overcharging, where if you overcharge somebody by a certain amount, so the sale is automatically voided. Those are the laws of overcharging, which we'll go over in just a moment. And the second is called Hafkat Sharim, which is price manipulation, price gouging, not the question of what happens if you overcharge someone now, but what happens if you've driven the price up so the legitimate price is higher than people can afford, right? Those are the two questions we're going to need to ask when asking what does halakha say about a housing bubble of this sort. So it all starts in number one. The Torah tells us in Vayikra, Parakhafei, in the context of the laws of the Yovel, the Jubilee year, so every 50 years, all ancestral lands in the land of Israel that were sold automatically revert to their original owners, to their ancestral owners. Now, since that's the case, so a few things are true. One is that halakha really discourages people from selling their ancestral lands. And therefore, even after you've sold your ancestral land, and even though we've already qualified that sale and said that after 50 years, or in the 50th year, the sale will revert to the original owners, in addition to that, we say that there's a rule that you're allowed to redeem the property. Either you or your relatives are allowed to redeem the property and buy back your ancestral property that you sold. Now, since we know that all sales will revert in the 50th year, there's a very easy way of figuring out the price of the field. Right? So if you sold the field for $1 million for 25 years, so then we know that if, 10 years in, you want to buy back the field, so it's very simple. You take, a million? Million, you divide it by 25, so it was $40,000 a year. 10 years in, you've used $400,000 worth of it. If you want to redeem it, you have to redeem it for the remainder, which is the $600,000. And in that context, the Torah says don't overcharge or underpay, and make sure that it's exactly as you said it was going to be. So that's number one. V'mispar shnei machar yovel, tikne meid amitecho, v'mispar shnei tvuot yimkar lach. When you buy from your neighbor, you shall deduct only the number of years since the Jubilee, and in selling to you, shall charge you only for the remaining crop years. L'fi rov ha'shanim tarben miknato, l'fi mod ha'shanim tamid miknato, ki mispar tvuot u'mocher lach. Based on the number of years left. If it's more, you pay more. If it's less, you pay less. Because he really sold you, he didn't really sell the land to you. He rented it to you, he leased it to you until the period of the Yovel. He leased you a number of crop years. Lo tonu ishet amitel, and you shouldn't overcharge, you shouldn't oppress, you shouldn't wrong your friend. V'yareita me'elohecha ki ani Hashem elokechem. And you shall fear God, for I am God. And that is the law of Ona'ah. right? That you can't overcharge, you can't deceptively overcharge the other person. And as we noted last week, the basic laws for this is Amarava number 2, Hilchata Pachos Mishutnik Nemekach. If you overcharge only by less than a sixth, right, let's say by 10%, so you should have now given back 600,000 and you give back whatever it is, let's just make it easy, 550,000, right, that's much less than one sixth. So then, even though the price was off by a certain amount, it doesn't matter. If it's Yoter al Shtut, if it's more than a sixth, so then a bitul mekach, the sale is nullified. Shtut is exactly one sixth, so then kano machzer onah, the sale stands, but you have to return the overcharge. And that's the basic laws of onah. Now, a parenthetical comment before we continue is what I put in 3. Somebody asked last week, though 2 weeks ago, though I don't see him now, doesn't this all seem unfair? Or doesn't this all seem unfair? Someone leased land, so why is it that the Torah says that not only does the lease end in the Yovel, in the Jubilee year, but whenever the buyer wants to buy back the land, assuming that he's coming to a new fortune, that he can buy back the land, no matter when, he can buy it back from you. Isn't that unfair? You've put in money, you've invested in the crops, you've gotten the land ready, and you expected, you have a certain number of years, and maybe 1 year you left it fallow so that it would plant better. Isn't that unfair to the potential buyer or leaser of the land? The answer is yes. Right? The answer is yes. Right? That is clear. In the Torah, we do not want people to sell their ancestral land. We don't want people to get to that state of financial need where they have to sell it. And even if you do, we really don't want you to sell your ancestral land, so we dissuade you from doing it. And even if you do it, we give you the upper hand in buying it back. And that's why in Yovel it goes back. We never want people to give up their ancestral land. So yes, it is unfair, it is biased towards the seller. That's just the way it is. There are some exceptions, and I just gave you in number 3 a few of the exceptions to it. There are some protections to the leaser, to the buyer. So you look in 3. A person should not sell his home or his ancestral field, even though it returns him eventually, unless he becomes impoverished. So the first point is the Torah doesn't want you to do this. You shouldn't sell your ancestral lands. He's only allowed to sell to provide himself with sustenance. You're only allowed to do it if you really need it. Nevertheless, if one transgressed and sold such property, the sale is valid. When a person sells his field in the era when the Jubilee year is observed, as we explained, he is not permitted to redeem it in less than 2 years. The one protection we do provide is that he has to give the guy at least 2 years to work it. Right? You can't sell it for 25 years and then 6 months later buy it back, because now the guy is, you know, what's he done? He's maybe planted, but he hasn't gotten anything out of it, right? And now he's going to buy it back for, you know, 6 months less of the price. So the guy got no use out of it. So he paid 6 months worth of a lease for no reason. You need to give him at least 2 years. The purchaser must benefit from 2 crops in these 2 years, and then the seller may redeem it for his written years of its crops. And these 2 years must be years when you can plant, so not the sabbatical year. Therefore, if one of the 2 years were the sabbatical year or a year of wind blast or blight, right, if there was a year when it was just unplantable, they're not included in the reckoning, right? So we give the guy 2 years to plant, 2 years object, not you know, just 2 years, 2 years of plantable years. If, however, the purchaser left it fallow 1 year and then benefited from the second year, or benefited from it 1 year and then lightly plowed it but did not sow it in the following year, these years are included in the reckoning. If the guy chose not to plant, that's his problem. But in general, yes, we advantage the seller to a very extreme degree. We put in very little protections for the buyer because we really don't want these sales to happen in the first place. Yeah. Yes, it is a transgression to sell your ancestral land.
So it's a transgression to buy?
No. I don't think so. It doesn't sound like it. But again, this is ancestral.
And if
yeah.
you needed it because you were impoverished, it's still a
No, then it's not a transgression. Right? You're not supposed to do it.
But he says, nonetheless, it's a transgression.
Well, he says, right, he said it's you shouldn't sell it unless he becomes impoverished, but even if you weren't impoverished, you just sold it, it would work. Right? So if you actually need it to live, so you're allowed to do it. It's not ideal, but you're allowed to. If you are not impoverished, you can't even sell it. If you do, it works. So that's just close parentheses. Yes, I will put it out there. The ancestral land laws are unfair to the buyers, but that's because we don't really want anybody to sell their ancestral land. Close parentheses. Okay.
But if that were the case, wouldn't you make it actually unfair to the seller rather than to the buyer? If you, who are you trying to discourage?
That's true, but what it's... We
you
really
would aggressively try and sell it.
I mean, what we want to do is, it's not just discouraging. We want to basically make it easy for things to go back to their ancestral owners. I mean, it's, yes, he violated something, but the point is we just want ancestral lands to be with the proper owners. That's our goal. It's unfair, but that's what it is. Yeah, I mean, there are all types of questions we can bring up. Like, with Neiver, aren't you causing someone to violate? All types of things. It's not our topic for now, but because that was a question, I figured I'd put it on.
I'm not sure it's so unfair to the buyer because the buyer knows this and he's factored into the price. He knows when he's figuring out the price of his land, he knows there's a risk that
right.
he may have to give it up after 2 years.
And it's not, it's right, so it's somewhat unfair.
Presumably, the price you would pay for that is less, the market price would be less than it would be in the asset.
Correct.
Price.
I assume that, like, land which is in Walled City, where the law is that it never returns after the first year, anyways, the price is higher, which is definitely true. Okay, but close parentheses, fine. However, that's the normal laws of overcharge. However, in number four, the Mishnah and the Talmud tells as follows. Not all things in this world are subject to the laws of overcharge. So, if you look in four, Eil dvarim she'ein lahem ona'a ha'avadim hashtarot ha'karkaot ve'ekdeshot. These are the things that are not subject to the laws of overcharge of exploitation, even if the disparity is more than that 1/6. So, the important one for our purposes is land, is real estate. Real estate is excluded from the laws of overcharge. Now, right off the bat, this is problematic, right? Because the Mishnah tells us that the laws of overcharge do not apply to real estate, meaning you could charge 5,000% over the going rate, and the laws of overcharge do not apply, period. What's the obvious problem? Besides for...
How do you reconcile that with the Torah?
Yeah, exactly, right? The original case in the Torah is about real estate, is about land, right? So it's very strange to say that the laws of overcharge do not apply to land when the original case was land. So to this, there are two answers, two possible answers. One is to say that the prohibition applies, but the laws of 1/6 more than 1/6, less than 1/6, exactly a sixth, all those laws don't apply. It's still forbidden, right? Lo tonu ishet amito still tells you that you can overcharge people when it comes to land. It's just that for whatever reason, and we'll see in a moment why, there's nothing you can do about it if you did, right? So the Torah is just telling you it's forbidden to overcharge regarding land, but there's nothing you can do about it. That's possibility one.
So it's a sin, but not...
But unenforceable, right?
Unenforceable.
Right? That's possibility one. Possibility two is that it is enforceable, but the laws are different than the 1/6. You know, the 1/6 benchmark is not relevant. It has its own laws, and all it's saying is when it doesn't have ona'a, what it means is it's not subject to the 1/6 laws, it's subject to some other set of laws. Okay. So, as we'll see, that will become relevant in just a moment. So, if you look here, so we'll skip to number five. If you skip to number five, Yeshua Falk summarizes the position of Ramban and of Nachmanides, who takes the first position that I mentioned. Then Marshal Zal Katav Daftid Matu Hani Avadim Shtarot Midin Ona'a. Marshall writes that when we say that these are not subject to ona'a, all we mean is that the laws of return don't apply to them, but it's forbidden. Right? It's forbidden, but it's totally unenforceable. And therefore, you can't overcharge on real estate, but if you do, there's nothing we can do. Once it's sold, and that's the end of the story. That's the position of Ramban. The position of Nachmanides, quoted by the Sma.
This also applies, because he told us 2 months ago, to undercharge, under
Right, underpaying, right? Overcharge, underpaying, same laws. Okay, but now let's go back to source four. So the Talmud says, well, where does this law come from? So, minani mili, detana rabbanan, v'chitim karum, emkar l'amitecho, kanu miyad amitecho, davar anikne miyad liyad. When we have the laws of ona'ah, we say that it says, when you buy from somebody's hand, which implies that the laws of ona'ah apply to something that I can hand over. And you can hand over real estate. So that's the Talmud's reason for saying that the laws of ona'ah don't apply. Then the Gemara asks a second question. Okay, this is true for selling land, but what about schirut? What about renting? Right? What about renting? If you overcharge on a rental agreement, does that have the laws of ona'ah? So do you say yesh lo'ona'ah, oin lo'ona'ah? Is it memkar omer achman avalo schirut? Is it that a sale is subject to the laws of overcharge but not rental? Well, dilma lo'shna'ah. So omer le abaye miktiv memkar le'olam memkar stomachtiv v'hainami b'yomei mechirehu. That rental is nothing more than a temporary sale, and therefore whatever law applies to permanent sale applies to rental as well. And therefore, if you take those two together, with both land, buying real estate and renting real estate, or a house, which for halakhic purposes is real estate, the law would be that the laws of overcharge do not apply to real estate. Again, what does that mean? So one possibility is the laws don't apply at all, or at least it's forbidden, but there is no law of return, right? It's totally unenforceable, either for rent or for buying real estate. You can never, right? You can't enforce the laws of ona'ah. If somebody overcharges, too bad, right? However, there are other possibilities. If you look at number six, the Talmud says as follows: Amar Rav, Amar Rav Chisda, Amar Rav Chasa, Boy Rebbe Ami. When we said that ona'ah ain lohem, that they don't have the laws of ona'ah of overcharge, what about bitul mekach yesh lohem ain lohem? What about bitul mekach? So what does that mean? So as we mentioned, there are three standards. There's less than 1/6, where if you overcharge someone by less than 1/6, it's unenforceable. At exactly 1/6, the sale stands, but the overcharge must be returned. At more than 1/6, right, the sale is nullified. So the Talmud asks, okay, well, what did we mean when we said ona'ah ein lahem, that they don't have the laws of overcharge? Does that mean they don't have any of these laws, meaning not the one, not less than 1/6, not 1/6, not more than 1/6, meaning I could charge you 5,000% and you still couldn't enforce it? Or is it just a very narrow law, namely that exactly at 1/6 the sale would stand and I wouldn't return the money, but at more than 1/6, we would nullify the sale? Right? Meaning, is the only difference between real estate and chattel the exact 1/6 mark? Where for chattel, the sale would stand, I would return the 1/6, and for real estate, I would not return the 1/6, but as soon as I hit more than 1/6, it's 1/5, so then both chattel and real estate, you could enforce the nullification of the sale. So that's the Talmud's question. Now, one position, and I just gave you the summary in number 7 from the Rif, from Yitzchak Alfasi, it is that this is in fact how we rule. That some people rule in accordance with this and say, so as I said before, right, one possibility is to say the laws of ona'ah don't apply at all to real estate. Possibility two is to say the standards are different. So one position actually accepts this in the most minimalist fashion possible, which is the only difference between real estate and chattel is the 1/6 mark exactly. If it's less than 1/6, right, overcharge, so then both real estate and chattel, the sale stands, you don't return. If it's more than 1/6 overcharged, then both real estate and chattel, you do have to return the sale. You have to nullify the sale. The only difference is exactly at 1/6. For chattel, the sale stands and you return the 1/6 overcharge. For real estate, you don't return it. That's it. That's the only difference. But that is a minority position that is basically not entertained by most of the authorities. Most authorities accept one of the following two views. And we'll read it inside in just a moment. One view is the position of Rambam, of Maimonides. And that is that when we said, ona'ah ein lohem, when we said that real estate does not have the laws of overcharge and you can't enforce it, even if it's 5,000% above the proper price, right? That's what we mean, right? There is no price on real estate, period, end of story. Presumably, it would still be forbidden, but maybe not, and we'll see in a moment why. If I asked you, why would you think that real estate, you couldn't enforce the laws of overcharge, no matter how much somebody overcharged, why would you say? Right. You would say it's either impossible or at least very difficult to say there's a price on real estate. Now, why is it difficult to set a price on real estate?
They're all different.
So one of them is all different. That's true of chattel also, right? That's true of shirts. That's true of anything, right? But real estate is even worse than that.
Right.
Exactly. Is that real estate lasts forever, right? Land lasts forever. So it's true that, you know, a slice of pizza 75 years ago may have cost a dime, right? And now it costs whatever it costs. But you can't buy the slice of pizza from 75 years ago. It would not be in any edible state right now. As opposed to real estate, right, at least the land, right? The house maybe is falling apart, but if we're just talking about land, let's make it easy. The land is what it was 75 years ago, right? And therefore, somebody could legitimately say with real estate, look, I understand the going rate is that this property is worth $1 million. I'm willing to pay $2 million because, look, I have all the time in the world, and I know in 20 years it's going to be worth $5 million. Right, so I don't care. I'll overcharge. I'd rather have it. Right? Real estate lasts forever, and therefore its value, it's much easier to say, look, we could overcharge because sometimes people are willing to invest that way in real estate. They're willing to overpay. Who cares? Right? There are certain things like that. It's just worth your time because they aren't going anywhere. Right? They just aren't going anywhere. Yeah. Right, so that was something we discussed 2 weeks ago, is how would we even determine prices? So we'll come back to that in just a minute, right? I want to bring it all together. But first, let's just set this out, and then we're going to have to bring what we learned 2 weeks ago back into the discussion. But it's a bit of a complicated discussion, but okay. That's the position of Rambam, right? That that when we say there is no ona'a by real estate, we mean even 1,000,000%. It doesn't matter because real estate lasts forever. And therefore, even though there's a going rate, it doesn't matter, right? Because real estate will last, we allow for the possibility that someone is buying it at a higher rate, whatever the case may be. We take into account the fact that eventually this property may be worth more, and therefore there is no ona'a. If you look at number 9, it's based on this line in the Talmud. Amar Rabba Bar Ula, what is land? Davar Hashaveh Kol Kesef. It's something which is worth any amount of money. In an objective sense, real estate is worth anything. Why? As some of the Rishonim put it, some of the commentaries put it, because look, chattel, you hold it, land, it holds you, right? It will outlast us, it will outlive us, and therefore, we can't really put a price on it. We can say there's a going rate, but, right, real estate has a certain quality to it, right, that it just survives, right?
So, smack in the face of what the Torah is saying, is that it almost sounds like the laws of ona'a should apply to real estate.
Correct. So in that case, you'd say it's very simple, because that there's an easy number on it, right? In the case of ancestral land, which goes back in the Yovel, there is a price. Not an objective price, a subjective price. Right? That's the difference.
Harvest, like what you could harvest from the land?
Well, there is, but because of the ancestral land, there's an end date to the lease, right? What you're really saying is, I rented it for this amount per year, and now I'm just returning it, right? And I have to return it. You're right. It's very complicated. And that's why the Ramban says it must be that it's prohibited, right? It's just, you can't enforce it because it's harder to put a number on it. Now, in the case of the actual case in the Torah, the ancestral land, so obviously the ancestral land, you can put a number on it. That's the point. But that was because subjectively you defined it, right? We don't take into account the price going up and down. We take into account how much you paid for it, right? But any other land which isn't under this ancestral deal, right, we don't have a subjective price. We have, right, an amorphous price, right? We have a price that, you know, could go up and go down. You have, and from a halachic standpoint, you have no idea what it's going to, you know, be worth tomorrow. That's one possibility. Many of the Ashkenazi Yisharim and Balei Tosfot say no. When we say ein lahem ona'a, what we mean is at 1/6, but there is an amount at which we will start enforcing the laws of ona'a, and that is 100% overcharge. Right? We understand that land is a bit more malleable, right? We get that, right? Meaning, we don't bat an eye. We would, right, we get upset, right, if someone is overcharging 20% on bananas, right? If someone overcharges 20% on real estate, we just sort of roll our eyes and we say, yeah, that's, you know, that's just how things are, and, you know, you take it or leave it, right? It's a seller's market, you know, we understand. But if a house yesterday cost $800,000, right, the guy turns around and sells it for $1 million, we don't bat an eye, right? If he bought it for $800,000 and tomorrow he sells it for $1.6 million, right, then we do bat an eye, right? We do wonder, how did that happen, right? Right?
Yeah, but it's the buyer's option. Maybe the buyer has conditions where that $1.6 million plays into his, you know, into his
question. Okay, so just hold that thought for 1 minute. Okay. So let's just take this information, what we said 2 weeks ago, and bring it together now. Okay, so question one is, is there any such laws of overcharge enforceable when it comes to property? Okay, so I'll put in the caveat now, and then we'll have to remember what we said 2 weeks ago. If there is an objective price, there's a market standard for real estate, so then, can you overcharge, and is it enforceable if you do? So, according to the Ramban, it's always forbidden. That's not necessarily clear, but according to the Ramban, it's always forbidden. Most of the commentaries assume that's true. Can you force someone to return the land, renege on the sale, give back the money if they overcharge? So, according to one position in the Gemara, which the Rif cites as one of the positions we've shown him, often is Rashi, yes. What's the difference between chattel and real estate? Only the 1/6 benchmark. But if it's more than 1/6, you can enforce it. But we don't rule that way. So, what do we say? Well, one of two possibilities. The position of Rambam, which is the position of Shulchan Aruch in number 8, is that no matter how much you overcharge, you can never enforce the laws of overcharging. The sale just stands. Period. End of story. According to the Balei HaTosfot, cited by the Ramah, if he overcharges more than 100%, then you can enforce the laws of overcharge, but anything less than that, you can't enforce it. Yes?
So like 2 weeks ago, you mentioned that if it's a luxury item, you can charge what you want and forcing the person to buy it. So with a house, you consider the luxury
item. So this leads us to our next point. Now we have to go back to our discussion 2 weeks ago, right? But all of this assumes a price. Right, this was the problem we talked about 2 weeks ago, is that the assumption of the Talmud, the assumption of the Rishonim, the assumption of all the authorities is that we're dealing with a world where there is a going rate, and now so I can look at it and say, you overcharged beyond that going rate. And therefore, if you overcharged beyond the going rate, then I at least have to ask the question, how much did I overcharge by? Right? It's imagining a world where if you went to some central authority, they would say, this parcel of land is worth $1 million. You charge 1.1 or 1.3 or 2, right? Is it less than 1/6? Is it more than 1/6? Is it less than 100%? More than 100%? And then we have to plug in all the positions and say, okay, let's return, right? Force you to return. Let's allow it to stand. Let's say you're a bad person, but there's nothing we can do about it, right? We have all the rules. But as we mentioned 2 weeks ago, this assumes a price. This all assumes a price. Even this discussion assumes a price. But as we noted, in the modern market, there may not be such a thing as a price. Right? Now, we discussed that in the context of chattel because I can buy online. I can buy from China. I can buy from anywhere in the world. I can buy a luxury item. I can buy it. I can want to pay more as a status symbol. All the different complications. Well, real estate is not movable, but we live in a much more global world, right? It used to be, like, who was buying land, right? You sort of knew your market. You knew what people were doing. People were farmers. They were buying farmland, or they were renting in a city, or they were buying in a city, whatever the case may be. But who was buying? How many people traveled? How far did you travel? Your market was somewhat closed. It was somewhat easy to come up with a price. Right? Nowadays, right, as soon as as soon as people from China decided that they wanted to start buying houses in Vancouver, your market changed overnight because, right, demand shot up and supply stayed the same, and prices went up in Vancouver by, right, whatever it was, 35% a year. Does that mean that they overcharged, or does that mean the price changed? Right, you look at the, right, when you read the paper, you listen to the news, no one's saying, no one's accusing the people selling their houses of overcharging. They're complaining that the market has driven the prices up legitimately, such that a house in Toronto costs 33% more than what it did just a year ago, right? Yes, it is unbelievable, right? It's astonishing, right? This is happening in my parents' community. My parents' community, right, for a long time, prices were somewhat stable. They moved at a reasonable rate, right? They grew at 10% a year because you basically knew, or whatever it was, because you knew who was moving into the community, right? You know, the commute wasn't changing to Manhattan. Everyone knew how much you were paying. And then, right, the Hasidim from Brooklyn decided that Staten Island's a bit of a cheaper option and moved into hundreds of families, and suddenly there was a new market introduced, right? So supply stayed the same, demand went up, prices shot up. That's just the way the markets work, right? Real estate, just like chattel, just like anything else in our modern market, is hard to put your finger on. And therefore, in addition to the questions of theoretically, could we enforce the laws of overcharge, we have to ask the same question we did 2 weeks ago. Is there such a thing as a price? Right? And the answer is not really. Right? Prices change so rapidly. Right? I mean, I had a friend. They bought a house for, you know, the 800,000, 1.6 wasn't theoretical. We had a friend who bought 800,000. 2 months later, the house next door, the same size, sold for 1.6. Why? Because they bought it to live in. The person next door bought it to rent out, right? And divided into two houses, right? And rented out two things, and they know, right? Rent also goes up 100% a year, right? Which is also astonishing. And therefore, right, in addition to the question of what is the theoretical law of overcharge, we have to ask, okay, but that's if you can set a price. But if you can't even set a price, right, or as you mentioned, people are willing to pay it, right? Ona'a is only deceptive overcharging. There is no deception here, right? People will tell you, look, I understand today my house is worth 1.5. I want to sell it to you for 1.7. Why? If you don't buy it, in 2 weeks from now, it will be 1.7, right? Right? So they'll tell you, you might as well pay it now. By the time we close, it'll be 1.7. You're getting a deal, right? We know what we're getting. So for three reasons, it's very hard to say that halakha would inhibit people from selling the price, because A, the laws of Ona'a don't really apply to real estate in the same way, as we mentioned. Two, there may not be a price. And three, Ona'a is only when there's an element of deception. If everything's above board, I can charge you whatever I want, and if you choose to pay, you choose to pay. And that's why I think that the real question, and the same thing is true of rent, but I think the real question you have to ask about the Toronto housing bubble is not the question of Ona'a, it's the question of Hafkat Sha'arim, is what we mentioned in passing at the end last time, which is, okay, the laws of Ona'a tell you that once there is a price, you can't take advantage of other people's ignorance and overcharge. The laws of Hafkat She'arim, right, of price gouging, tell you that you can't manipulate the market in such a way that prices are driven up. Now, or more specifically, the Talmud says that in cases of certain things, the government should intervene to ensure that prices don't go up, right? To ensure that prices aren't shooting up at unimaginable rates. I think the bigger question, and I'm not just saying this theoretically, you look at the news, this is the question, right? This is only last week, right? I read it last week, right? But I think it was only a few weeks ago that whoever it was, the Premier of Ontario, said that maybe they're thinking about reintroducing price controls, right, or rent control, right, because people, a slew of people who complained that their rent went up 100% from year to year, and they just can't afford to live where they were living, and they can't pick up their life, and they can't move. Right? It's very nice to say move down the block or move, you know, a few miles, but if everything goes up 100%, your job is still here, and your kids are still in school, it's not so easy. Right? So they're thinking about introducing rent control. That's exactly the question of Hapkat Sharin. Right? Is, should anybody take responsibility to prevent prices from going up? So here's the problem. The Talmud has this law called Hafkat Sha'arim, that the courts or the government must intervene and make sure that certain things don't go up in price more than 20% at a time. Right? However exactly you define that, but fine. But what things are included? Because most things that we mention, luxury items, we don't care. We don't care how many thousands of times you drive at the price of diamonds. It makes no difference in halakha. You don't want to pay for it, don't buy it. But what about rent? Or what about, right, or buying a house or renting a house? Right? Is that the type of thing that the court would intervene on? That government should intervene on? Now, this is complicated. So you look at number 10. I gave you the summary. Shulchan Aruch says as follows. Chayavin beitin la'amin b'munim al sha'arim. The courts must establish appointees over prices so that people will not profit as they choose. People should not benefit on things that are necessities, life necessities, like wine, which was at some point a life necessity. Now it's not, but it used to be, because people couldn't drink water because it was contaminated. So wine, oil, and flour, only 1/6, which really means a fifth. Right? Outside sixth, inside fifth, whatever. Right? Quick math, right? If something's $100, a fifth of it is 20. The total now would be 120, therefore a sixth of the total is a fifth of the original. So we talk about a sixth, fine. Okay. Very complicated math. Fine. So the laws of Hakat Sharim of preventing price gouging apply to this category called Chayei Nefesh. Now what exactly is Chayei Nefesh? What is called a life necessity? So there are basically three positions. Some think that it's all food, right? Some think it's only specific types of food, right? The SMA, which I gave you in 11, divides it into three categories, and I'll just go with that for now, which says that there are really three categories. There are articles, I'll read in English, the laws divide into three categories for Rambam, articles which life depends on and the like, such as wine, oil, that should be oil and flour, you can profit up to 1/6 and no more. There are absolute life necessities, right? We'll call it bread and milk, okay? That, you can't allow the price to shoot up more than 20% at a time. Two, articles which are not food at all, such as cosmetics and incense, you can profit as much as you want, even many times the principal. And then three, things which are necessary for food, such as cumin, other spices and the like, is permitted to benefit, that should not be up to 1/6, that should be up to 100%, right? Ad hakeifa v'lo yoter, up to 100%. The SMA says that there are three categories, right? Things which are absolute life necessities, where you prevent the price going up by 20%. Things which are not life necessities at all, like diamonds, where we don't care how high the price goes. And then things in the middle, like spices, where you can sort of do without spices, but it's sort of expected that you're going to want your food to taste like something, right? So we allow the price to go up 100%, but not, let's say, 500%. Right? If they start going up 500%, then the courts will intervene. Okay, now what about real estate? Right? Which category is it? Is it a life essential? Right? Is it sort of a life essential? Is it not a life essential? So the problem is as follows. In all the classic sources, all of them, anything before the 20th century, the only thing that ever gets brought into the discussion of price controls is food. The assumption is anything which is in food is not a life essential, is not a necessity, and therefore the courts will never intervene, the government will never intervene, it will let the price go up to whatever it wants, and as long as you don't deceptively overcharge, I don't care how high the price goes, it doesn't matter. But then in the 20th century, 19th and 20th century really, you start to find people who play with that a little bit and aren't sure. So I gave you just two examples who relate directly to real estate. So Rabbi Yosef Eliyahu Henkin, who was one of the leading authorities in the 20th century in New York, was approached with this question. The government, not you know, halakhic government, the United States, had imposed rent control. And so now, the law is as follows. The halakha is as follows. that there's a general principle, dina de malchuta dina, that the laws of the government are enforceable, halachically, right? You have to keep the laws of the state. There is an exception, though, and that is that any law of the state that goes against the Torah is unenforceable, right? So, for example, obviously, if the government said you have to work on Shabbat, right, that would be unenforceable. It doesn't matter, dina de malchuta dina, right? There are limitations. So someone, or alternatively, laws which are unfair, right? Laws which are considered unfair, in the sense that they aren't universal, they only apply, you know, to, you know, if you have a society where the law is that, you know, anybody who is, you know, friends with the, you know, baron or whatever it is, right, gets, you know, is not taxed, and all the poor people are taxed, you know, are as much as you can possibly squeeze out of them, so you're allowed to evade taxes, right? It's only fair laws, right? But when laws are fair, halakha says you have to keep them. So Rav Yosef Eliyahu Ankin was asked, okay, the government has introduced price controls. Is that fair? Such that halacha would tell you that if a Jewish landlord and a Jewish tenant are in an agreement, are in a rental agreement, that they have to abide by those laws or not? Or can the landlord say, it's not fair to me that you're artificially keeping the price down on rent, I could give it to somebody else? Right, because right often the way the price controls work, at least in New York, and I know that's how they are thinking of introducing it here, right, is that price controls are only until there's a new renter. Right, a new renter, you could drive the price up as much as you want, because then they can choose to move in if they want. Can the landlord say, it's not fair, I could rent it to him for 100% more, why do I have to only raise your rent by 5% a year? Right, it's not fair, it's not enforceable halachically. Rav Henkin said, no, it is fair because rent is essential. And therefore, it is proper. Now, it might not be that halakha would do it itself, but it's at least enough within the spirit of the law. Right? I want to be careful. I don't know if he would say that halakha would do it in a halakhic state, but his point is it's at least fair enough that if someone else imposes a law, we can acknowledge that it's fair and just and moral, and therefore we can enforce it. And we can say that as a Jew, you have to keep it, regardless of the fact that it's not a Jewish law. It is forbidden, so he says. The government's law of tenancy is just and accepted, especially in big cities, for it is targeted against those who gouge prices and skin the hides of the indigent. Even if it appears at times as cheating landlords who are not wealthy, he said sometimes it's not fair. Sometimes you have a landlord who's barely making ends meet, right? And, you know, it's not fair to him. He says, okay, but that's the way of law, right? Law is set for the community. For the most part, what you're dealing with is landlords. So the question is, how much of a profit are they going to make? Not whether they're going to make ends meet. For the poor people, the question is, are they going to live there or are they going to end up in the street? Or when you get to the situation it is now, it's not even poor people anymore, right? It's, you know, your rent last year was $3,000 a month and now it's $6,000 a month, right? You know, upper middle class people are also going to be suffering under this, right? So you're allowed to do that. The government's allowed to do that, and halakha respected it, right? At times violating justice. We follow the majority of cases. As far as the law is differentiated between dwellings of the indigent and luxury homes, this does not diminish the law's strength. It increases it and makes it more just, he says, right? We take the spirit of the law, Scott Sharin. Luxury items, look, you want to make a distinction between basic houses and luxury houses? Go, be my guest. But if the government says, look, these areas are, you know, not luxury areas, they're normal areas where normal people live, and therefore we're preventing you from raising the rent more than 10% a year, or 5% a year, or 8% a year, or preventing you from driving the real estate prices up more than 10% a year, or 20% a year, whatever number you're going to put on it, Rav Henkin says that's moral, that's just, and halakha would recognize such a thing.
Isn't he discussing rent and not purchase?
He's talking about rent. Right, and I don't know whether he would say the same in purchase, right?
Because you can make an argument that...
Correct, you could say that owning a house is a luxury. Correct, you could say, right, owning is a luxury, renting... But at least, in theory, right, Rav Henkin opens the possibility that halacha would recognize the justness and the morality of controlling prices in the context of real estate. But I tend to think you're right, that since the barometer is going to be, is this dvarim sheish ben chayi nefesh, is it a necessity or not, he would probably limit it to rent and not buying, because... Yeah, buying is a luxury, right? Rent is not. That's my guess, but I can't prove it because he doesn't say. Now, in theory...
It's also an investment.
Correct. It's an investment, and maybe that's different. There's a whole bunch of reasons we could distinguish. But theoretically, right? Rav Henkin at least opened the door to the possibility that halacha would recognize government controls, or maybe even halachic controls, over price gouging in the context of real estate, at least in the rental market, and maybe in the buying market, though you're right, I'm not sure he would. He doesn't say. At the other extreme, right, David Menachem Munish Babad, writing in 19th 20th century Poland and Ukraine, the Chavetz Chaim Sharon was livid with such things. And he says, no, it's not true. He says, there was a time when, as an under extenuating circumstances, I could understand it. Not because of the laws of Chavetz Chaim Sharon, but he said, during the war, right, whatever war he's talking about, right, I'm not even sure. I'm not sure which war he's talking about. Wherever, in Poland, they had imposed rent control. Now that makes sense. It was, you imposed rent control on the soldiers who were out at war. You didn't want them, you know, their, you know, wives and families to be kicked out of their homes, right, by price gouging landlords while they were gone. So he said, look, I get that. That's not price gouging. That was a temporary measure because, you know, people weren't at home, they weren't working, I get it. But what, now the war's over and people want to keep these price controls and artificially keep prices down. Is that legitimate? He says, no. Today, logic dictates the opposite. That this is a great cheating of landlords. Fulfilling, your ox will be slaughtered before your eyes and you will not eat therefrom. Strangers control their property and they have no savior. This doesn't even aid the renters, only the senior renters. He said, it's not fair. It's not fair, right? The only type of law we recognize are laws that are fair. It's not fair to landlords, it's only fair to renters. And it's not fair to new renters, it's fair to old renters, right? I mean, great, my grandfather lived in a, you know, in a rent-controlled apartment, so sure, he paid what he paid in, you know, 1960 in 2010, right? But I, when I was renting in New York, right, I was a new renter, right? So he says, it's not fair, right? On a level of justice, why do you pick on the landlords and why do you only benefit, you know, long-time renters? What about, you know, you get this weird situation that you have people who, you know, have no kids in school, have no kids at home, you know, have no expenses and are living in these 3-4 bedroom apartments paying what they did in 1960, right? And then you have, you know, young families, people starting off still in college, still in university, whatever, and, you know, the prices are exorbitant, but they're a new renter. They just moved out of their parents' house, right? He said, how is that fair? It's arbitrary that you're picking old renters, right, and not new renters. You're not taking into account landlords. He said, it doesn't matter. Right, for them, this repair is just, right, each day there are more new people who need to rent dwellings. And besides, what does it do? And this is the claim that's happening now, is rent controls prevent new buildings from being bought, which in the long term will, right, will decrease demand, decrease supply, increase demand, will drive prices up in the long term, right, price controls are artificial. He said, for them, this repair is destructive, causing the rent to increase greatly, and one cannot find a dwelling, which was not the case before the war. There'll be no extra houses. There'll be no nothing, right? This is especially true when we know that the law comes from certain elected officials who are liberal with communist and socialist views. In order to oppress the wealthy, that nothing is new in the world. Nothing is new, okay? It's to oppress the wealthy and take their money. All of these views are against the Torah. He says, besides, it's the socialists. You can look at the Hebrew, right? He says, right? How, if you can read that in the last line, ha-communistin v'socialistin, right? Right? He says, besides, this isn't a Torah value. This is socialism, right? This is communism, right? This is external to our system. He says, forget it. So here, as I mentioned, the laws of overcharge, I think, don't apply. First of all, because the laws of real estate in general, both for rent and for buying, are extremely limited. Two, as you mentioned 2 weeks ago, determining prices nowadays is near impossible for anything. Three, is all of this is above board. The bigger question is, should the government step in and try to control rent and maybe even control the price of buying? But I would leave that as an open question. Rav Henkin says yes, because it's aimed at helping people who are poor, people who can't afford to live in houses, or people who are going to be kicked out of their house and have to switch their kids out of school and find a new job because they simply can't afford their apartment that went up in 100% this year. Rav Babad says no. Laws are only, right, fair. They're only enforceable if they're fair. And this is only fair to old poor renters, right? Not new renters, not landlords, not poor landlords, not rich. He said it's arbitrary and therefore it's not binding. Right? Do you see that the same questions that are being raised right now, right? Should they control rent in Ontario, in Toronto, right? The Postim discussed it 100 years ago, and, you know, it was the same question. It's nothing new. the same argument. On the one hand, maybe it's fair, it protects those who are unfortunate and can't pay another 100%. On the other hand, it drives, right, it prevents new houses from being built, it drives, right, it prevents new supply from being introduced to the market, it will increase demand in the future and drive prices up, it's unfair to landlords, right? You see that same tension, those same disputes coming up over and over again, and it all comes down to this question, is can we expand this category called life necessities to include rent or not? And there really isn't precedent before the 20th century, but you see that the same ethical arguments and the economic arguments that are being made right now by politicians are the same one the rabbis were arguing about 100 years ago, because it is the question of, does this category of Hafkat Sharim give us a language to talk about it? I will just add the last point, because I found this astonishing, was that this became a big deal in the 1970s. I don't know exactly what was happening in New York at the time, but all the rabbis in Hapardes, which was a rabbinic journal, talked about this. And many of the authorities who wrote there, they wrote like one-page letters, were on the side of Rabbi Babad, that you aren't allowed to have price controls in halacha. Halacha doesn't recognize it. And in what, I do not even believe this, but I will tell it to you anyways. Rabbi Eli Melech Friedman, writing in Hapardes 21, says that he knows of renters who were so convinced that price control, that rent control was immoral, that even though the government didn't allow their landlords to raise the rent, they went to their landlords and willingly raised their own rent and pays them more. I don't believe that such a thing ever happened, but he claims that people were so convinced it was immoral that they did it themselves. I don't know if that's true, but okay, I found it fascinating nonetheless. But I think that's the real question that we have to ask, is does halacha give us the language through this notion of chayi nefesh, of life necessities, to introduce rent controls or not? And as you see in the postgame, just to finish my thought and then we'll take questions, as you see in the postgame, the same arguments that are being made nowadays by politicians are the same ones that the rabbinic authorities were playing with, proving that these questions will continuously come up both in halakha and secular law. And the question we have to ask is, do we view Hafkat Sharim as a language to use to talk about rent controls or not? Like I said, it's an open question, but at least one that we should think about, and, you know, if you read the news, you will think about. Yeah?
No, I just want to tell you, I did ask my landlady today, I said, you really should raise my rent.
Wow, okay, I take it back. I take it back, and... Did she take it? Did she take you up on it?
She eventually did, yeah, because she had another unit that she took back, so she needed.
Okay, well, you're a better person than I am, so.
I had a question. We went kind of very far along the question. This is something that is permanent, and you eliminate precious metals because they're luxury items and diamonds, which are also permanent. But when you look at what it said here, there were three categories: slaves, documents, and real estate. Oh, and I think things given to the temple.
Right. I mean, that's the laws of Ona'ah, right?
Right. So that doesn't have anything to do with permanence.
Correct. Those are different stories, and I wanted to focus on real estate, but you're right. I mean, documents are different because they're not considered having intrinsic value, and the Beit HaMikdash is different because it's not really someone who's in the commercial market, and yeah. So those are all different. I wanted to focus just on real estate,
so
but you're right.
Really just permanence.
Correct. Not just permanence, but that's the case with Karka. Okay. Thank you again to Zeissman for hosting. Thank you, Steve.
I want to thank Howard Dury and everyone for attending.